This episode is part of our ongoing series with NI Connections, where each month we have the chance to sit down with someone interesting from Northern Ireland who's living and working overseas. To find out more about our global diaspora, listen to previous episodes in the series and sign up for a free monthly newsletter. Please visit niconnections.com. Thanks so much, and really hope you enjoy today's conversation. Also, one quick little note. As is often the case when we are trying to track down and have long-form podcast conversations with Northern Irish people living in remote and strange parts of the world, we did run into a little bit of technical difficulty with this episode. The Wi-Fi was a bit choppy. There was a lot of dropping in, dropping out. And paradoxically, like in a very strange turn of events, for some reason, me sitting in my fancy podcast studio sounds like I'm speaking through, I don't know, like a tin can or a potato or something. And Kit in this episode has the wonderful radio DJ bassy voice. So yeah, look, that's just the way things go. Sometimes we've worked hard to repair the audio. We've listened through it a few times. We're really happy with it. It sounds great. And we absolutely, absolutely, absolutely didn't want to miss out on sharing this wonderful conversation with you. And actually having to listen back to it a few times and do a bit of work on it was incredibly enjoyable for me. So in some ways, I'm glad I had the chance to go back to this one a few times myself. Awesome. That's enough for me. Say goodbye to bassy, full quality Matthew's voice and say hello to Tin Can Matthew heading your way. I promise you that your ears will adjust to it and that the absolute gold dust that Kit shares today is worth it. All right, let's go.
So, random place to start. I often start here just to kind of get the ball rolling. What's like one of the first things that you can remember, like early memory, early experience, like what's some of the things that kind of jump out whenever you hear that question?
Oh, that's a good one, actually. I've not been asked something like that before. I think probably would be going into the mountains, in the Moor Mountains with my dad. It was a horrible day and we'd planned to go sort of up into the High Moors, up either towards Comida or Donard. And it was just horrendous. And I remember being blown over, like literally blown off my feet a load of times. And it got to a point where dad decided that it was enough. So I vividly remember walking down past the ice house with his hands on my shoulders,
wow,
holding me to the ground. So yeah.
It's such a surreal experience, like having to make that call. Because like you're there for the day and you're kind of like, oh, you know, like we're used to the rain. We know what's up. And then, like, there is that moment where you're kind of looking at each other. You're like, should we keep going? Like, should we turn back down here? Like, what's the wise thing to do? I'm already halfway up.
Yeah. No, I've had to make a couple of those calls. Sort of, I made one when I was at last winter. I went up to the Mourns to ski, and I got again to the saddle between Donard and Comida, and the weather was horrendous, and I was putting on my ski goggles and I thought, what's the point? The snow's rubbish, like I can't see a thing. So yeah, I had to walk back down.
That's hardcore skiing right there. Like it's the hike up yourself to, you know, to do the own free fall. Like that's the homie G's.
Yeah. But no, I got a couple of good days over the winter, and yeah, the snow was perfect, and yeah, I got a day out skiing with my brother, had my dad up as well. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, it was perfect.
So I mean, the Mourns is really, like, to oversimplify and highly romanticize your life, which is what I'll be doing a lot of in this conversation, is you know, the Mourns were kind of your back garden. Like you're pretty local to there, weren't you?
Oh yeah, like live in Newcastle, so like, yeah, obviously one of my sort of first and early memories, and when I'm at home, I'm always in the mountains. At school, did Duke of Ed.
Oh, glorious.
Like sort of camping by myself at like 15 or 16 in the mountains. And yeah, definitely has a real sort of appeal and draw.
So was kind of the love of, I don't know, the wild, like, was it thrust upon you, or was it something that you kind of sought out yourself?
No, it was sort of, it was always there when we were growing up. Like, dad did mountaineering when he was at uni, and sort of mum has always been quite adventurous. And we always went out sort of as kids when we were young, sort of whether it be into the mountains or into Tullymore on like picnics or down to the beach. There's always sort of been this connection with the outdoors and nature and wildlife. So it always seemed very normal and natural that that should have a huge part of my life.
Ever go swimming in Blue Lock? So that's a silly question.
Yeah, I've been swimming in all sorts of stupid places.
Have you got the cold water bug? Have you been bitten?
Not quite. I've like been swimming in locks in Scotland, rivers in Scotland, in the Arctic. We didn't get a chance in the Antarctic, but there's something quite exciting about it. But I definitely wouldn't say it was my thing or that I've been bitten. But I do it every now and again.
Okay, so let's stay on track. I'm all over the place today because I'm so excited. I guess, like, in as long or as short as you want, and this is just blowing past, like, just decades of your life. Like, but tell us about, like, the path that led to Antarctica. And what I mean by that is, like, where did the seed come from? Where did the idea come from? How did the opportunity arise? Was it something that you were actively seeking out? Was it something that kind of fell on your lap? Yeah. Like, tell me about that, because I think that's... It's the biggest question I have is, like, how does someone from County Down get there, you know?
Like I said, there's always sort of this interest in the outdoors, and that I was brought up with it being sort of very normalized and sort of hearing all of these adventure stories from my dad. Like, he went to Greenland when he was at uni. So sort of I knew that these places were attainable. Like, they were realistic. It wasn't something that you hear about sort of in rumors or that you read in books. Like, I knew somebody who'd gone off and done similar things. So going out into the mountains when I was younger, the Scouts in Newcastle was huge and really sort of kept me interested in all of that. And yeah, when I think I went to the Arctic when I was 17 and 18, and then That sort of really solidified the idea of wanting to sort of do more of that, and being sort of part of a university mountaineering club and literally going out into the Scottish mountains every single weekend in good weather, horrible weather, doing sort of some of the classic Scottish routes in winter, or realizing that the weather's too bad and just walking to the pub. Like, all of these things are sort of resulting in me being where I was.
So did you do uni in Scotland then?
Yeah, I went to Dundee. So it sounds a bit odd. When I was choosing unis, I got a list of every uni in the UK, and all of the ones that didn't do geography were struck off the list. And then from that list, any unis that weren't near mountains were struck off the list.
Oh, I love that.
Like, it was just something that I had to be close to. So them having a very active university mountaineering club was huge, and I was part of that for 4 years. And yeah, through them I managed to convince them to let me borrow a minibus, and we drove it to the Alps from Scotland. I'm not quite sure how I managed that, but it was great fun.
That's incredible, man.
And then after uni, worked in a school in Switzerland, and got very involved with the ski and expeditions program there, and which is how I heard about this job in Antarctica. It was a charity thing between the two schools, and they were doing a disabled ski touring expedition where we pulled a guy in a sit ski up off piste, and then it allowed him to ski it off piste and enjoy it. And we did that for about 3 days, sort of living with this guy, sort of helping him in and out of his chair. And the girl who was a member of staff from the other school had previously worked in Antarctica, and she suggested that I applied. So, yeah, it all worked out quite well in the end, really.
Unbelievable. So, like, paint the picture of, like, what was this job description? And why did you go for it?
So they hire maybe about 3 or 4 people every year, and sort of pre-COVID. She had previously done the job, and sort of having been skiing with her, suggested that I apply. But it's such a diverse role that you have to be able to get on with people and sort of lend a hand to everything. But the role that I ended up getting was as the postman. So that was it's quite a novelty. Like, when I told my sister that I was moving to Antarctica to be a postman, she didn't believe me. She thought I was lying her up. So yeah, it's a funny one that sort of everybody thinks it's just a joke, but
I mean, the nickname is literally like the Penguin Post Office or something, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I've seen the documentary. There's a documentary about it, and I hadn't seen it before I went. And when I got back, I sat with my parents, and it's maybe a 40-minute documentary. And I kept pausing it and talking through it. And we must have been there for about 2.5 hours. And it's really, really good. It's really accurate. It sort of gives a really good representation of what I was up to.
Start to like fill in the blanks for in my head anyway, but I think for a lot of people listening of like, what is the crack with Antarctica? Like the more I look into it, the more confused I get in terms of like who owns it, like who occupies it, what it's used for, what its purpose is. It just seems to be like this constant flow and amalgamation of many, many different moving parts. And this small little island, you know, way, way, way down south has kind of a really interesting history. So give us just a bit on that because I'd love to know.
Yeah, so Antarctica was discovered, sort of it being the seventh continent. Once it was, there was sort of a lot of territorial claims to it and sort of even now there still are. But after the Antarctic Treaty was signed, they were all rendered null and void. And the treaty set aside the continent for scientific research, sort of peace reasons and tourism. So the reason that I was where I was because during the Second World War, the British who had a territorial claim on the Antarctic Peninsula, sort of they said in 1944 that there was a lot of ships being sunk in the Southern Ocean in the Drake Passage and that they needed to protect it. But really, it was sort of a bit of a land grab. So they wanted to set up this post office because stamps have a monetary value and help to solidify a territorial claim. So they set this up in 1944, and it was a secret British military operation called Operation Tabarin. And it sort of developed and changed into the Falkland Islands Dependency Survey in 1944, which was the precursor of BASS, the British Antarctic Survey, who do so much research on the continent and are one of sort of many countries. The Americans are there, Ukrainians, Chinese, more as well. But the base that I had was closed in 1962, and it was just left abandoned, really. And sort of fell into disrepair. The roof fell in the building. The penguins moved in, set up shop. And then in the 90s, there was a movement to sort of clean up a lot of the old rubbish that was left on the continent and particularly the peninsula. And countries who had sort of sites left were told that they either had to clean them up, get rid of them, or sort of restore them. So that's what they did. So they came in, they're managing the site now. So they run the post office on behalf of the British Antarctic Territory. And they also conduct wildlife surveys in terms of recording the numbers of penguins on the island and feed that back to the British Antarctic Survey, where there is already a wealth of data. So we're continually feeding back into that. There's a small gift shop. And there is a museum of sort of artifacts from that period, but the people, stories of people who used to live on the island as well.
You ever seen the movie, what's the title? Matt Damon, he's on Mars. It's called Martian, I think.
Oh, yeah.
So like, in a way, like I was driving in today and I was like, that's kind of like how I imagine your life was like there. I would love you to correct me, obviously. But like, I imagine you just kind of like in this kind of like bunker, like living in this extreme condition, but how free were you? Like how much could you be outside? How much could you kind of wander around? Were there strict regulations of where you could and could not go? Like tell us a little bit about your own like lived definitely. Experience there.
So it's a tiny island. It's probably about the size of maybe slightly bigger than a football pitch. Wow. And half of it's off limits. You can't go onto. It's completely sort of controlled to let the wildlife just be free without human interference. So that restricts where you can go quite a lot, which meant that we were working a lot. So we had one day off every 2 weeks where the island would be closed and you'd have it to yourself. So in that sense, with what you're saying, yeah, definitely. To be on a tiny Antarctic island by yourself, living in a Nissen hut, which is quite primitive, but very, very cozy. It was plenty warm. We just didn't have running water or mains electricity. Yeah, you could definitely draw some parallels
Yeah, it's a little bit like astronaut-y. Like, just whenever I was thinking about it again, I've never been to Antarctica, but it's that it's like beyond off the grid. And I mean, you have your quote unquote crew members, but like other than that, there's not a lot of other human interaction. I guess you had the benefit of the many, many tourists that would come to visit. Who else would come? Like, yeah, so, I imagine like scientists coming and stuff. Like, maybe that's just complete nonsense.
Yeah. No. We had scientists coming in and visiting to do a bit of work. We had an electrician that came and stayed with us to try and sort out the wiring and stuff in the Nissen hut. We had conservators come down. They stayed with us for about 5 weeks to assess all of the artifacts in the museum. So there were quite a few people coming and going, but there was periods, I think when we were there initially, we were iced in for seven or 10 days. So we didn't see anybody else bar the people that we were living with for that entire period of time.
Wow.
And when your water is coming from the ships, that makes it quite interesting that you have to go down to the beach, find icebergs and chip bits off and melt them down. So it is quite basic and primitive.
Crazy, man. I mean, you were, by the sounds of it, pretty well prepared before you went. I'm sure you had an abundance of training and things like that. But am I right in saying, like, this is a Bell-Tell reference, so feel free to correct it. Like, you'd done three Arctic trips before this one. That in itself is bit of an enigma to me. So you already mentioned you went once whenever you were pretty young. Like, why did you go back the second or third time and then ultimately, you know, I guess the fourth time?
Yeah, I was quite lucky in the sense that sort of my extracurricular background and even my academic background really sort of feed into these environments. But to do the job that I was doing, you don't need any of that. I'm sort of a bit of an anomaly when it comes to that having a master's in polar and alpine change. And most of the people that go down here sort of aren't sort of that kind of specialist. Yeah, in terms of going to the Arctic, yeah, I've been fantastically lucky. I went twice with a charity organization called British Schools Exploring Society, now British Exploring Society, and went to Svalbard, which is about halfway between northern Norway and the North Pole. And then I went to for 3 weeks, meant to be five, and then went to northern Norway for six. And they were sort of very formative moments sort of in shaping me into who I am today. Definitely sort of life-changing moments, and like I said, really sort of not pushing me, but guiding me on a path and towards something that I'm passionate and want to be doing. And then the third one was to Greenland. That was during my master's. We went out there for 2 weeks and got to go on the glaciers and do all sorts of stuff. So having a mountaineering background as well definitely helped with that.
So when you say that they were like really formative moments for you in your life and like really shaping, like speak a little bit more to that. Like, what was it about those experiences that left such an impression on you, or that, I don't know, taught you something or revealed something to you that you kind of still look back on as worthwhile today?
Yeah. Like, when I was in just doing these kind of things, they really do teach you. They teach you that maybe everything isn't easy, like that it can be rubbish and it can be hard work and it can be a bit miserable. But if you put the effort and sort of push through this, that you're going to get some sort of reward at the end. So when I was in northern Norway, it rained solidly for the first 2 weeks. And like, we were in tents, so it was hard work, but we were in such a beautiful place and we got to go up onto glaciers. I got to meet fantastic people who I'm still in touch with. And that was, what, 9, 10 years ago. And yeah, it definitely showed me an environment that I wanted to spend more time in. And the people that were there with me, they were people that weren't necessarily conforming to a stereotypical 9-to-5 job. They were doing something that it wasn't necessarily a job in and itself. It was maybe more of a vocation that was earning them money.
Yeah.
And yeah, it shows you that you don't necessarily have to conform to this working machine, that you can go off and you can do your own thing and still get by and sort of be happier rather than sitting behind a desk for 8 hours a day for the next 50 years.
What is the, like, the appeal of the remoteness of these locations for you? Again, like, when I just, like, picture you in my head, like, going out to these places, like, it's almost like the same thing that drove, like, people into, like, a monastic tradition, or, like, people to go out into the desert. You know, there's something to be found in those very remote parts of the earth that maybe can't be found whenever you're living in a hustling, bustling city, you know? So talk to me a wee bit about that.
It's the remoteness, and it's maybe the people they meet as well. In Antarctica, everybody's very like-minded. I know Antarctica is maybe a bit of an exception, but it's a destination in and of itself. It's not a waypoint along a journey. It is an end point. You have to want to go there and make the conscious effort to. Anybody who's going there has that mindset. But in other places, even in the Mourns, when you make the effort and you go out, even if the weather's rubbish and it's horrible, you'll bump into people. And it's people of a similar mindset that I can still go out and enjoy myself despite this weather. And sort of maybe a more modern spin on it would be getting away from sort of the, like you said, the hustle and bustle of life, the being glued to your phone, sort of being a slave to social media or emails. Even if you just go out into the mountains for 5 or 6 hours, you're getting away from that. If you go camping, you spend less time on your phone. And in Antarctica, that was one of the real joys of being there, not having to constantly be looking at your phone or technology or emails, social media, just being able to get away from it. It's a much sort of simpler way of life. It's probably an awful lot healthier as well.
Yeah, it is interesting. We are incredibly, incredibly plugged in. And I think all of us, like, from the 16-year-old to, like, the 60-year-old, like, when you go to somewhere like the Mourns, or you have that moment where you're almost forced to disconnect, there is that kind of breath of fresh air where you're like, this is what I've been kind of, like, looking for. But it can be so hard to kind of pry yourself
you
away from those things.
You consciously have to make the effort to get away from it.
And I like what you said, that you used that word, you know, making the effort to go up the mountains, because most times it's inconvenient. Like, even if you live there, even if you live close by, it's still an effort, and there's decisions that have to be made to actually get you to that place. But once you're there, you kind of reap the rewards of it. Also love what you said about how...
You really do.
Like, the people that you meet along the way, it's a certain type of person. Like, even the Mourns is like, it like filters society in some ways. And Antarctica is that on steroids, where it's like, it takes a very specific type of person who would want to do this, and then who would have the commitment to actually go and see it through. Like, tell me a little bit about your, I've used the word crew probably inappropriately, but your roommates, your housemates, your island mates, I don't know what you call them. Like, what sort of, like, loose backgrounds are they coming from? Like, why did they go to somewhere like that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, like I said, I was a bit of an anomaly in terms of my educational background was in those environments, but one of them was Lauren. She has degrees. Is it a degree in philosophy? And she was a manageress in a shop in Portsmouth, not hugely into the outdoors. And I think this was a huge step and, like, something very out of her comfort zone. And she was fantastic. Like, she was as good, if not better, than everybody else. So you don't have to sort of have these hard outdoorsy mountaineering people coming to do this job. It can be somebody who just comes in with the right mindset. Lucy, who is the base leader, had been there previously. She is a PhD, has done work with in Canada in terms of clothing research, and I think it was the Canadian military. But she'd been there before. She was a dog sled guide. Vicky had a master's in marine biology, I think it was. So she was sort of already into the outdoors and into wildlife and animals. So she fitted into the role that she had very well. And she's currently working as a ranger in the Cairngorms in Scotland. So
awesome.
It does attract a wide range of people from all over the world. So another of the girls, Heidi, she was from Finland. A guy the year before me was from France. So it's not just people from the UK with mountaineering or scientific backgrounds that they're trying to get.
That's great. There's been a few times in the conversation that this thought has kind of come up, and it was triggered again whenever you were talking about clothing research and, and the Canadian military. Like, if you're really like looking at your gear and your equipment that you had, like, what are like the things that you absolutely would not do without? And if you want like something that you wish you absolutely had have brought with you, or a better version of it?
Ooh, I don't know. The sort of the one thing that surprised me that I did bring that I actually did use quite a bit was shorts. I wore shorts quite a lot. Yeah. Like in mostly inside. There was a couple of days I had shorts on outside, but
why not? I mean, you gotta show the grandkids something, you know.
Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely.
That's such a classic moment.
Yeah, there was a t-shirt was sort of more normal. And sunglasses. That's the biggest thing that I was glad to. That is maybe something that you don't think about, that you've got 24-hour daylight. As soon as you go out the door, you're wearing your sunglasses. And like snow blindness is a real thing, and it can cause you serious, serious issues. So I think that was maybe the most important thing. Maybe a bit of a surprising one, but like hats, gloves, warm jackets, they're all hugely important as well. Something that I wish that I brought. I don't know. I can't think of anything.
It was like I missed a real trick here. I'm like sitting here thinking, oh, you should have done like a desert island disc spin-off here. It's like the perfect opportunity. Only instead of a desert island, it's an ice island.
I know. Well, there's so much ice there. When we were there initially, we got a ship down and the island was completely iced in. They couldn't drop us off. So they had to go back to South America. So we had to jump ship, effectively hitchhiking in the Antarctic, and had to jump between two ships. So we were on three ships before they finally got us in.
Crazy.
That was a fun one.
This is just complete left field. We're in the complete and utter, like, if you thought this conversation so far was a freestyle, like, we're moving into the absolute wild card territory. Like, how did you manage your own circadian rhythm in like an environment of like pretty much 24-hour sunlight? Like, how did you manage your own sleep patterns?
Fantastic
your
own question.
Rhythms? Like, that's got to be really difficult, because here we are, you know, we just had daylight savings in, you know, Ireland, UK, and we're dealing with darkness. And so, you know, like, there's a lot of us in the community that are using like really bright lights in the morning to try to stimulate like the lack of light and things like that. Mm-hmm. You kind of have the opposite problem in, well, I guess one half of the year. So tell me about that.
Yeah. So when you wake up, it's bright. When you, through your whole working day, it's bright. When you're having your dinner, when you're going to bed, it is always bright. I remember writing postcards home and to my parents, sitting up at midnight without any lights on at the table. And unless the room that we slept in had curtains, so it was reasonably dark, but the rest of the building didn't. And I think sort of as it gets darker, you naturally become more tired. Yeah. So with the 24-hour daylight, I think it was very easy to fall into the routine of overworking and working too much, that subconsciously you think that because it's bright, you're meant to be working.
Yeah.
So it maybe created more of an effort that you had to consciously say, you know what, we'll have to stop. Maybe we need some downtime or something before we go to bed. But it's an interesting one, how the 24-hour daylight can sort of mess with your mind.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the eternal summer, only it's also cold outside. It's very, very strange. You know, naturally, like, you know, like, growing up here, you know, in the summertime, we all have more energy. We all go to bed later. We all have. So to have that like level of intensity kind of cranked up is very interesting. There's been low hanging fruit that I've been like trying to like avoid or delay as much as possible. And the experiences that you had in Antarctica were a little bit, and I say, I stress the little bit, of a microcosm of what we experienced globally during the pandemic in terms of the lockdowns, in terms of being isolated, in terms of, you know, being stuck with our work on our laptop in our house 24/7 and not knowing where we draw the line. So I'm curious, like, did any of those lessons prepare you for what was to come, or was it completely different and it shocked the system?
It was maybe some sort of preparedness, but it was different. So we'd heard about sort of this virus when we were down there, and we didn't really think an awful lot of it. But the day that we flew back into England was the day that sort of lockdown started. So when I was back in Northern Ireland, I was in a cottage by myself for 6 weeks. So I guess that helped in a sense. But I also had more freedoms and more luxuries in a way than when I was in Antarctica, that I could contact my friends whenever I wanted. I could sit on FaceTime or Skype with them when you were allowed to go out for, was it an hour a day or something like that? I could actually go out. I could go for a run. Whereas in Antarctica, I physically couldn't leave the island. We had no boat, so no means of leaving. So in that sense, it was good. But I think I was maybe in a better position for it than most people. And when I came back, my job was over, so I didn't have to sit at a laptop really for very long doing work. I think that would have been a particularly difficult thing. So I was quite fortunate not to have that, in a sense.
Interesting that you spent a lot of your time on the island working with real analog technologies in terms of like the postal system, you know, like that's not something that a lot of people get to experience these days. Like we were laughing the other day, I don't know if it was with my granny or mate, about just how like we have a wee daughter, she's like a year and a half, and she doesn't know what a landline telephone is because we don't have one at home. Oh, it was definitely granny, because we were at granny's and like the phone rang and you could just see her face like, what on earth is that thing? And we were joking about how, oh my word, like modern kids. Yeah, like modern kids are like so far removed from more analog stuff. Like we were like, when will she ever write a letter or a postcard, you know? So yeah, it's interesting how you spend a lot of time dealing with those things.
So many people don't know.
Yeah.
And I think since I've come back from there that I am definitely writing more postcards and letters, and like there's people that's the main way I communicate with.
Awesome.
And it's fantastic because everybody loves getting something through in the post.
Yeah.
Like you're excited to find out what it is. If you see sort of a handwritten letter coming through, it does pick you up a bit. But yeah, to use sort of more primitive technologies and not having somebody there, if you don't know how something works or something's broken and needs fixing, you have to do it. There's nobody else that you can ring to do it. So you have to work it all out. It was fantastic to get away from a lot of the modern technologies, and life sort of took a little bit of a slower pace in a sense. But the postal stuff was interesting. It wasn't something I envisaged that I'd get so into, but I think we sent about 60,000 or 70,000 postcards.
Wow.
And all of them were hand-stamped.
So,
like today, when you send a letter or whatever, it'll go through a machine and get cancelled. But we had to do it all by hand. And then there was other people that would write to us, and I was the one who was always writing back. And it was always quite humbling that people had made the effort to write to you and to write back to them and have this connection. It was nice. It was something that I was quite surprised that I got so into.
It's really beautiful. I'm just gonna a wee throwaway thing here for your own curiosity. There was a story you'd need to look into for the exact details, but of a guy who was really, really into radios in Donegal, like I don't know, say 50 years ago, and made contact with a Russian astronaut. And they developed this like really interesting relationship. Like this random dude in Donegal was just really into radios, and this like Russian guy in space. And it was like he became like a source of news for the Russian guy, and like had to tell him that like the USSR had collapsed and stuff. So I don't know. There's just so much, such an interesting wee story for maybe to do a bit of digging into.
Just you mentioning about somebody from sort of Donegal, I don't think we're from up there, but whilst I was out in Antarctica, there was several people from Northern Ireland who were there. And yeah, it was so strange. There was the first ship that came in, there was somebody from Northern Ireland, and obviously you recognise the accent, it stands out a bit. So I asked her where she was from. I said, oh, from Northern Ireland. I'm like, no, where are you from? And yeah, she was from Banbridge, I think. And yeah, I asked her that if she was in Newcastle again to call into the family's office, and she did, and she said hello to my father and my grandfather, and it's there's something special about the people from here, and it's wonderful to bump into people from home from at the end of the world, really.
Yeah, totally unexpected. That's amazing. I remember I spent 3 months in Rwanda just after school. We were like staying in this village outside of Kigali called Ramagana. And then we went on this like kind of 3-hour trek inland, so like even more remote. And we went to this random lake and went for a swim. And then like it was like something out of a movie. Like in the distance, like you just saw this pasty white figure emerge from this river, and just like, you know, like just like started like marching towards the land. And he came up to me and he was like, "All right, mate." And I was like, "No way! Like that's not possible!" Like I met this like dude from Northern Ireland called Hugh, and we just had this like unbelievable bonding moment. If you know, because you are in this new place, but you have like such a strong connection because you're from the same place.
But people from everywhere else in the world just don't get it.
Yeah,
but people from everywhere else in the world, they just don't get it, and especially I know someone who knows them, and it's it's just so small at home. And yeah, people from elsewhere just don't get it.
So let me ask you this then, like slightly in the same vein, like how has your perception or your opinion of home changed kind of as you've spent time away from it?
Every time I go away, and like I'm extraordinarily lucky to have been to some amazing places, and like even now living in Switzerland, every time I come home, I appreciate it more and more. I think when you grow, I grew up in Newcastle, and you think that everywhere is so beautiful or so close to the outdoors, but isn't the case, obviously. But yeah, every time I come home, I think I appreciate it more and more, being able to get out into the mountains or to go to the beach or to get out into the forest. Northern Ireland as well is just such a wonderful place, and a lot of it's to do with the people. Like the people at home, they're good crack, which you definitely don't get everywhere else in the world.
Yeah.
But yeah, every time I come back, I think I appreciate it a little bit more.
It's cool, man. Very, very cool. Okay, back to a bit of structure. Questions we've asked every single person.
Go for it.
Some are biggies, some are a little bit easier, but we'll jump off the deep end here and just go for it.
Cool, go for it.
Most challenging moment of your life so far, and if you don't mind sharing, how were you able to overcome it?
Oh, wow, that's a good one. That's a hard one, actually. Oh, most challenging moment. I honestly don't know. I want to come up with some sort of like groundbreaking sort of answer, but, and I come up with just seems rubbish.
I'm always interested in like the initial reaction, because these questions are impossible, because like you can't actually get the actual answer. The actual answer will hit
you
when you're in the shower, you know, in like 2 weeks time. But like
you'd be putting on a sock or something.
yeah. It's those little ones, like some of those initial ones that maybe seem, you're like, why am I even thinking about that, you know? It's very surprising what you can kind of come out of your own brain sometimes.
I guess it's maybe not a specific event, but like dealing with people.
Mm.
Like dealing with people has to be one of the biggest challenges. And like throughout life, there are going to be so many people that you don't get on with or that wind you up or irritate you. And I think it's trying to compartmentalize it and sort of maybe not trying to rise to it is one of the biggest challenges. And if you can do it, it'll help you in sort of so many aspects of life.
Mate, that's a quality answer right there. Here, I enjoyed that. It's something different as well. You know, like it's often people go to a specific moment, but I really like that. I guess like
the specific event.
Yeah, like the flip side then. And again, like feel free to take this in whatever way you want. Like most successful moment or like moment you're most proud of or thing you're most proud of?
Yeah, I've done a lot. And again, maybe not the answer you're looking for, but I touched upon it earlier. It was when I actually heard about Antarctica. It was this ski touring expedition it was paraplegic. And it was meant to be one of these moments for the kids. It's like, wow, we're really privileged. We're well off economically. We're physically fit. We can do what we want. And here's somebody who was the same age as me, and he was wheelchair bound. And we, you know, like I said, we spent a few days with him, and we got involved with every aspect of his life, like moving him in and out of his chair and feeding him. But it was really humbling and really rewarding. And it's something that, yeah, I'm actually quite proud of. It was such a short period of my life, and something that I didn't really have a huge part of, but to see that and to do something so small to make a guy the same age as me feel that much joy and experience sort of the freedom that I get reasonably often was hugely rewarding and very, very humbling.
So telling that out of all of the kind of the adventures and the Instagram moments along the way, that's what stands out, you know? I think that it speaks a lot to kind of like what we really care about as people, and we often start chasing the wrong things, or the things we think that are going to be so incredible are actually, they pale in comparison to some of those more human connections, you know?
Oh yeah, definitely. I completely agree.
Okay. If you could take anyone from Northern Ireland out for a pint or a cup of coffee, who would you take them? Who would you take? Where would you take them, and why?
Anybody from Northern Ireland?
Dead or alive?
Not my mate. Anytime I go home, I love going to the pub with, or go for a coffee with, one of the guys I grew up with. We've been friends for 28 years, and yeah, we've grown up together. So that's maybe not the answer you want, but who is famous from Northern Ireland? Oh, not from Northern Ireland, but from Ireland, if that would do. There's an Irish explorer called Tom Crean. I'd have loved, and he opened a pub called the South Pole, so he'd definitely be up for a drink.
Oh, come on, 100%.
So yeah, that maybe not quite answering your question to its fullest, but yeah, I think that would.
I'm going to be honest, I was like fully waiting for a Shackleton answer there. Like that's where I thought it was going to go. I don't know a lot about him, but I know enough.
That would be a toss up between them. Shackleton's pretty incredible, but Tom Crean's maybe a little bit less well known.
Well, why him? Tell me
between the two of them.
Tell me a little bit about him, because I've never heard the name before.
So he did a lot of Antarctic expeditions with Shackleton and with Scott. And I think he was universally sort of accepted and respected as being sort of one of these polar prominent figures. So Scott and Shackleton never really got on, didn't see eye to eye, but they both had huge amount of respect for Crean and wanted them in his team. I think he was quite humble as well, but good crack. So I'd have liked to have met him.
Awesome, mate. Very cool. Final question then, and it's the place we usually end. If you could go back to, say, an 18-year-old version of yourself, let's say you've just kind of finished high school, you're waiting on your results, you're deciding, you know, am I going to go to Dundee? And you just had like a couple of minutes of that 18-year-old's time, what sort of things would you say to him?
Yeah, that the stuff that you're interested in is going to take you places. Like, I was very lucky to find something that I was so passionate about a relatively young age that has sort of transpired into my adult life. So yeah, keep going and doing the same stuff that you're already doing. Maybe I suspect care less about what other people think. It's and just do what makes you happy. Like, stop trying to jump through other people's hoops or meet other people's expectations. Just do what you want.
Awesome. Very cool. I'll give you the bonus question. This is the official bonus question that often gets cut.
Go for it.
Because it's impossible, but I love it. Let's just go for it, guy. We're looking for first reactions here. And you can take a pause, okay? Right. What is the kindest thing that someone has ever done for you?
Oh. Yeah, so there was one time in Antarctica, I think we'd been there for maybe, I don't know, it was maybe 2 months or something. We'd already been there, so everybody was already sort of pretty tight, pretty close. I think I just had a rubbish day. I was tired, irritable. I went to bed sort of not having had dinner. I was just fed up. And the people I was with obviously picked up on this, and one of them wrote a note sort of saying that, oh, I can't remember what it was. So, like, G'ing me up, and she wrote it from a penguin. And it was just, yeah, it was fantastic. It was so nice, so sweet. And it was just, yeah, it was very kind. I don't know if that's, I could say that that was the kindest moment, but that was something that, as being, yeah, really looking out for your mate and, yeah, trying to pick them up.
That's so awesome. Mate, that is, again, that's the sort of quality answers we're looking for on this show. Thoroughly enjoyed that. And it's not, you know, you'll get the actual kindness when you're putting your sock on later, as you said. But no, I love just kind of some of those things that float up to the top of your head to begin with. You know, they're so, so interesting. But
yeah, you'd be sat putting on a sock, staring into the middle distance. And yeah.
Yeah. Well, Kit, yeah, I have to say, honestly, like, this has been an absolute pleasure. I'm glad that the Wi-Fi gods let us get through it and that we were able to make the connection today. And I really appreciate you spending the time and sharing everything you did.
It's just wonderful that we managed to get it done now.
Awesome, mate. And big, big thank you to NI Connections once again for making this episode possible. And really look forward to touching base with you again next time. Cheers.
Unbelievable stuff. Look, thank you so much once again for listening. My name is Matthew Thompson, and we're on a mission to share 350 conversations that celebrate Northern Ireland and the incredible people who call it home. Massive thanks once again to NI Connections for making today's episode possible. And like I said at the top of the show, you can find out more about our global diaspora, listen to other conversations in this series, and sign up to their free monthly newsletter by visiting niconnections.com. Other than that, hope you really enjoyed today's episode. And I look forward to catching you again soon.